quick note before this episode begins. This show is hosted on the lovely Incomparable Network, which is supported by membership, and it's that time of year where we remind you that you too can become a member of the Incomparable. You can sign up for a monthly or yearly pledge to support this and all of your favorite Incomparable shows directly. Members receive tons of bonuses, like a bootleg podcast where you can hear episodes of certain shows right after they're recorded without having to wait for the edited version. You get a members-only community on Slack. You get a ton of bonus episodes from different shows on the network. In fact, we are going to be making a very special episode about a certain musical TV show, and you are not going to want to miss out on it. To sign up, you go to theincomparable.com/members, where you can choose your level of membership and which shows you'd like to support. Thank you so much to all the current and future members of the Incomparable Network. And now, on to the show. The Threepenny Opera was written by Bertolt Brecht, adapted from a German translation by Elizabeth Hauptmann of John Gay's English show, The Beggar's Opera, with music by Kurt Weill. Despite the multiple names attached to its creation, it's closely linked with Brecht, the writer and director who altered Western theater with his revolutionary work. This show tells the story of Macheath, a violent criminal who marries Polly Beecham. Her father, who controls the Beggars of London, tries to have him hanged, but is thwarted by Macheath's close connections with the police. Here with me to talk about this unrestrained critique of traditional theater and capitalism is Glenn Fleischman, writer, podcaster, and typesetter extraordinaire, among 100 other things that are too long to list here. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Threepenny Opera. Hello, Glenn.
Hello. Thank you for having me on this exciting podcast series.
Thank you for being here. And what are we talking about today?
Talking about the Threepenny Opera, known in German as Die Dreigroschen Oper, because it was written in German originally by the music's by Kurt Weill, and the librettist and author of this book is Bertolt Brecht, the very difficult Bertolt Brecht.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about Brecht.
Oh, good. Most people do.
I already have a digression, but that just reminded me of the other day in class. Our professor just had someone read a passage, and it was by a French author. And so it was in English, but there were occasional, like, the word in brackets in French. And she would be reading, and then when she got to the French word, she just, like, is clearly fluent in French. And so just pronounced it perfectly and with this very strong French accent, and then just kept going. And I was like, I mean, okay. I would have just skipped it.
No, it's fun. It's fun to – it's fun if you know to pronounce the words, but – yeah, this is one of my favorite musicals, and so I was glad to have a chance to talk about it, because not everybody's interested in Bertolt Brecht or musicals that were written in the 1920s and things like that, but it's really influential, I think, in a lot of ways, and I think we could talk about a lot of details, but I think, like, Stephen Sondheim couldn't exist without the Threepenny Opera, I would argue. I don't know how much he would say that himself, but... it's a very modern thing written in the 1920s that you can feel the tendrils stretching, you know, until now and will continue to stretch into the future.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited to dive into it. I do have to say, Monty, who was on an earlier episode, did Chess, and he said, like, oh, is it okay to do a lesser known musical? And I was like, Glenn's doing Threepenny Opera. Anyone can do whatever they want.
Is Chess a lesser known musical? I guess it hasn't been produced as much. Here's the thing in researching. So I did some background research so I'd be informed. I mean, I've been studying Threepenny Opera, reading it, singing songs from it, telling people to listen to it and buy, you know, for decades. I mean, literally for, gosh, now over 30 years probably. So there's that. So as a result, I feel like I'm a little more attentive to it. But in doing the research, I discovered it had heights of higher popularity. It ran for thousands of performances off Broadway in the 1950s, for instance, and it's had multiple revivals in the U.S. and it's been performed worldwide. So it's not something like, Company is a modern, I think, really difficult, interesting play. And it's staged all the time. There's a lot of really notable productions of it. But Threepenny Opera is, I would say, a much harder play to stage because you're not going to do it as like a community theater. It's really, you'd be hard pressed because of the musical requirements and singing and the nature of the show. But I would say that it's not a it's not a musical person's musical because it's not that obscure. It's not like a little gem only people, you know, like Merrily We Roll Along. I've seen that produced, and I think that's an achievement if you've seen a production of it, right? And that is a, you know, a musical person's musical. And this is somewhere between, it's not necessarily Chess, but it's between that and, you know, something like Company or, you know, Fiddler on the Roof being at the top of that, because every high school in America is producing Fiddler on the Roof right now.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting choice because it's like it's so old and prolific and is so important for the history of musical theater. But at the same time, I think has fallen out of fashion and fallen into much more out of the public consciousness in recent years.
Yeah. And it's weird because for me, it bubbles up all the time. So in current politics, because it's a, you know, Brecht was a socialist and sort of on the communist side, even the play is like this hilarious deconstruction of the flaws of capitalism, sort of shown through corruption and criminal behavior and normalization. And it's a really resonant play today. And so I'll be hearing something and I'll just have lyrics come unbidden from one of the songs will pop into my head. I'm like, yep, that's perfect. Like that makes, it's completely contemporary. You could stick, you know, that politician in and it would seem like it was recorded, you know, it was made today.
Yeah, that's very Brecht. Very omniscient of him. Yes. Ooh, yeah, I feel like that's going to be me from now on because I had not listened to it before. I had heard of it, but really didn't know anything about it. And now I have a much greater familiarity in listening to it for this recording. So I'm interested to see how it's going to pop up and be relevant in different ways.
Which recording did you listen to, would be my question. You listened to the Raoul Julia or the Donmar Warehouse? Or
so I listened to the Broadway Revival from
1997. Now, see, that, oh, that's funny. That one I don't know, even though I should. That is, who was in that? That was an interesting cast, too. Alan Cumming did a revival in 2006 at in Studio 54, which is amazing. Gosh, I don't know who's in the 97. I don't know who's in the 97 production. Isn't that funny? The one I'm thinking of is from 1976, 77 is the Raoul Julia one. And the Donmar Warehouse, it was done in England in 1994 with a really fresh, crisp translation.
Oh, just kidding. I listened to the version from 1976, but when you click on the album, it thinks that it was released in 1997.
Oh, so you listened to – so that was the Raoul Julia one.
Yes.
That's great. That's what I cut my teeth on in English, and it's, I think, almost definitive. And then they made a really terrible movie, which we can talk about too. I think that's a fantastic one to start with. The Donmar Warehouse became my favorite translation later. Because it's a really very edgy and much more, I don't want to say accurate, but the common, I mean, I'm getting into some of the details here, but the common translation that they use for most productions is, the 76, 77 production had a new translation, but by people who had translated it before. So it's a little fresher. It's not as totally watered down as some of the earlier English ones were, or the prominent English one where it was. But the Donmar Warehouse translation is even more, it's just really hard-nosed and amazing. Mm-hmm. I'm getting into the weeds here before we even talk about the play, though. I'm sorry.
Oh, this happens a lot. It's okay. But I would like to back up for a minute. Yes. And I think we'll get deeper into the plot and the mechanisms of this story a little bit later, but just to give a brief concept, this is, as we mentioned, this is a German opera from the 1920s, and the basic premise of it is it's really parroting capitalism in a lot of ways, and it's the story of Macheath, who is this horrible criminal, and he convinces Polly Peachum, who he's known her for 5 days, which is not great, but he convinces her to marry him. They elope, but her father is the friend of the beggars. He leads the beggars of the town, and their conflict ensues, and they're trying to get Macheath arrested.
That's exactly right. And this is adapted from The Beggar's Opera, which is a 18... Oh, shoot, what's the year? It's John Gay, and it was an 18th century ballad opera. And it's a translation that got worked on over time. And in fact, there's a whole story, which I didn't know the backstory to this. I knew that someone else had done the translation from English for him, but it's his assistant, in some versions, lover, more accurately, Elizabeth Hauptmann. And she did a translation for another purpose. And he basically like was trying to shop around a different play, couldn't get a bite. And he's like, oh, I have this translation I did of The Beggar's Opera. And that's what turned into this. And then he brought Kurt Weill on, who was a very avant-garde composer at the time. So Hauptmann worked with him on the translation. And then he also inserted ballads by François Villon, which he stole from a German translation of Villon's work, who's French, and later had to pay royalties for. And there's even some Rudyard Kipling in it. So it's a really interesting pastiche of sources. But it's transformed by him by like so many things that he did. It's transformed into something that's like a radical rethinking. And so you have conventional themes and plots and ideas and characters, you know. It's not, you know, Commedia dell'arte, but it's like the kind, you know, these like the beggar king and so forth. And yet it's turned to the ends of him making a political statement that is nonetheless very entertaining and very, you know, brings you along with him, even though really none of the characters are sympathetic just about.
Yeah, let's talk about Brecht for a little bit.
Let's talk about Brecht.
So I have feelings and thoughts about Brecht, like starting this week, because I really didn't know a lot about it. It was sort of the same thing. Like I had heard of him, and it's the kind of thing as so I have a minor in theater and I'm studying directing. And so Brecht is the kind of person that like people make references to him and you're like, yeah. But this was the first time that I actually sat down and read some of his some of the things he's written, like about theater and about production, and learned like what he's actually all about. And he's fascinating.
Yeah, he is. He's a, you know, seminal figure in theatrical history because he worked for a really long period of time. He was, oppressed at different times. He had to leave Germany. You know, he's kind of an enemy of the state at various times. And then he's in communist Germany. He's not beloved there. Here's my Glenning moment. I have a friend I worked with many years ago whose parents, I forget if she's born in America or Germany. Her parents were German and they lived in Germany during the war, which was a difficult thing because I believe at least one of them was Jewish. And that was a complicated situation. But her father had worked with Brecht and she was like, yeah, he really a difficult guy. Like I didn't get any specific stories, but really, really difficult guy. And anyway, but he's known for being incredibly didactic, very difficult, very rigid. And yet he wrote a lot of plays that are, you know, very producible, very entertaining, which is super weird, right? The thing that precedes this, I think, is fantastic, and it's even more obscure, is The Seven Deadly Sins. And it's like a piece for a ballet dancer. Lotte Lenya and a ballet dancer perform it as two parts of the same person. They're both called Anna, and one sings and one dances. And it's like a song cycle, and it's just beautiful and weird. There's the rise and fall of the city of Mahogany. So these things are, you don't watch them. You know, there's some stuff that you watch out of pain. You're like, oh, okay, well, this is important in theater history. I need to watch it. I'll go see this production. When I was in college, the head of the theater program produced a play by William Wordsworth, wrote one play, and it had basically never been produced. I mean, almost never in hundreds of years. And he produced it, and you saw why he had never had it produced. But it was useful, it was useful pedagogically to see it. So I've seen that play, right? And merrily we go along. His plays you want to go see, the Caucasian Chalk Circle, it's just all these, you know, musicals and plays and theatrical stuff. And you're like, these are worthwhile. And that's super weird to have someone who is so, you know, like difficult in trying to teach you and force you to believe things and break down. I mean, there's no fourth wall in Brecht. There's barely like a third and a second wall. There's just like the play and yelling at the audience. And yet it's great. It's enjoyable.
Yeah. We read about these stories of like he would get almost to dress rehearsal and he'd look at the set and be like, nope. And then like completely redo all the set. And I can't even imagine what his budget was. And like he would, like an actor would do something and he'd be like, why'd you walk there? And he'd be like, because that's the blocking. Like, that's what you blocked. And he's like, no, I didn't. And they'd be like, Brecht, you literally did this. And they'd have to prove it to him. And then we was like, well, that was last week. And this is this week. And I'm saying that's bad.
There's a story I read a number of years ago about how he's rehearsing something. I don't think this is his production. I think he's in the audience and someone else is directing and staging it. And it's like the 1950s. And he starts shouting from the audience. This is, you know, again, rehearsal, dress rehearsal, starting, Drachhaufen, Drachhaufen, which means like pot. has to be escorted from the theater is the account that I read. Might have been apocryphal, but I'm sure it happened. You know what I mean? Like it's,
seems
it's
likely. Kind of
yeah.
Brecht was uninterested in making traditional theater. He was fascinated because he was a really big socialist and communist and Marxist and all of that whole category. And so he was fascinated with this idea of alienation, which like in Marxism is, you know, alienated from your labor and it's the bad thing. But Brecht took this idea and applying it to theater, thought that it was false for audiences to like be what he called emotionally manipulated by mm-hmm. the performance. Like he thought it was wrong to like try to get into the emotions. So he would always want to be so-called alienating the audience and reminding them that it was a show and breaking the fourth wall constantly and just making sure that everyone was very aware all the time that this is a theater and it's not real.
Right. Which reminds me of, I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's Glenn Gould. Like one of the things the pianist Glenn Gould said about performance, which he stopped doing and he went in the studio and only, you know, recorded radio shows and recorded stuff impeccably, was he had some notions about the tyranny of the audience or tyranny of the performer towards the audience. And he wanted to break out of that, which is, I don't fully understand his position there because it seems a little contradictory, but it's still that idea that it's an artificial experience. And that, I mean, this is where you get into the works of Walter Benjamin too, who I have this page of Brecht in front of me and it's like, oh, he collaborated with Walter Benjamin, which I didn't realize. And Benjamin is also like a fundamental thing in my life. And having read him as a, you know, late teens in college about just this, the alienation of the observer from the medium. And Benjamin was also a communist and interpreted things from at least this perspective of the tyranny of the lens, the male gaze, early thinking about that. It's this idea of theater as an artifice and being aware of it and pushing back so the audience cannot be either the stage isn't tyrannical towards the audience, but the audience also doesn't have the comfort of being removed from it and watching it as a spectacle. It's their problem too.
Yeah. There's a particularly biting essay in which he talks about revolution in opera and basically criticizes everyone else for being unwilling to consider it from the fundamentals up. They're like, oh, everyone's allowed to revolt when you're within the defined category, but no one's taking the step to actually reconsider what everything should mean.
Wow, that's great. That's great. I really love that. And it's just, you know, it's, boy, it's funny. It's like, it's not that I don't like different kinds of theater. It's just, I feel like what he does was so revolutionary that it continues somehow to be revolutionary now. It doesn't seem, some of the plays and material may seem dated, but the approach doesn't feel dated in the way I think some forms of, you know, some methods of acting, like method acting, or some theatrical devices. You know, what else is produced regularly from the 1920s? Not a lot of stuff. There's a very few things where they're presented as historical acts. So they have to be radically reinterpreted. And Three Penny Opera can be presented as a, you know, as a play. I mean, it's not Shakespeare. That's a great example of something, you know, that's over 100 years old that people perform all the time. But Brecht isn't like in the canon like Shakespeare is. But it's just you can stage his plays and you don't have to make apologies for the mechanisms they use. But I don't think he's, it's funny. I don't think he's hard to watch, even when it's staged really viciously. And even though it is tempting to, I remember the Steve Martin, this is funny. I think of Steve Martin when we're talking about this because his book, I'm blanking out the name, his autobiography that he wrote several years ago about how he deconstructed stand-up comedy in a way that made him really happy and took like 10 years to build an audience very slowly. And suddenly he became super famous. And then his deconstruction of comedy was just being parroted back at him by the audience. It had become comedy. And that really bummed him out, and he stopped doing stand-up. And I think Brecht, at some level, his sort of deconstruction of theater and his alienation effect or distancing effect that he brought to it doesn't ever get old, because it's always that same estrangement. You can't, mutate around it and go like, oh, yes, Brecht. Well, of course, we can incorporate him. You can stage Brecht badly, so it's merely enjoyable. it's merely, a play that we are watching. But you can't just say, oh, yes, we've encompassed that into our worldview, and now it is just, this pedestrian thing. Ah, Brecht. It's like, no, it still has that effect. I mean, Sondheim's the same thing, right? You see a Sondheim play that's 50 years old, and you don't go, this is a 50-year-old play. Like, other things are made at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Because I think that, going back to the point you made at the very beginning, like, these are themes and ideas that still are so relevant. And so even though, we have different music styles now or whatever, like, that's all relatively superficial stuff that's on top. Whereas the underlying ideas are still so relevant. And then this alienation effect is still, even though it's much more commonly used and Brecht has had a huge influence on the field of theater, it's still not the norm and not what we expect from a show. And so it still has an effect on the audience.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Still, it didn't become the mode of theater. It still stands on its own as a separate thing that people have to cope with.
Of course, now every time I see a show that breaks the fourth wall, I'm going to point at it and go, that's Brecht.
Yeah, so Brechtian.
Because pretty much.
This is how you get your ennui and your hipsterism. It's, oh yeah, it's Brechtian.
Yeah, I'm a real director now. I know who Brecht is.
Just stand there and shout Drek Hobbit and you're okay.
All right, we got our big Brecht conversation out of the way. That was very necessary.
We Brecht the fourth wall.
Hey.
Right.
Okay. But yeah, with Three Penny Opera in particular, like, these themes that are so important is this this criticism of capitalism and inequality and just making a mockery of it really throughout the show.
Yeah, it's a world in which everything. There's so much corruption. It's all about corruption at every level. Is that you have a king of the beggars, you have a master criminal, you have a corrupt chief of police, and into the middle of this, it's Victoria's coronation is supposed to happen. That's kind of one of the key events happening at the end of the play, or the end of the musical, and. So there's nothing good. There's no good transaction. There's no good life in this. There's just all of these people interacting with various levels of mendacity or criminality.
Yeah, even as I was listening to it, reading about it, I was like, there is not one likable character in this entire show.
Right. I think Spelunker Jenny or Low Dive, Low Down, Ginny, Jenny, all these translations, she's the most sympathetic at some level, because she's been wronged, and she takes action. She's one of the few people to take action to redress her wrongs, and her life is not so hot. So you have sympathy for her. She hasn't really done anything bad except sort of been buffeted around. So she might be the most sympathetic, and that's, of course, that's the role that Lotte Lenya sang largely, and I saw a production with Bebe Neuwirth in that role as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it's worth shouting out as well that I don't know how to say anyone's name.
Lotte Lenya.
Yes, she I believe won a Tony for this role, which is the only time an off-Broadway actress has won a Tony.
I saw that. That was amazing. I had no idea. I mean, that's the production that she was in America that ran for was just in an inordinate amount of time. It was like 2,500 performances. And here's the hilarious part. I mean, not to just read people off. It was, it ran for, 2,700 performances, in 1955 and 1956 largely. But, here's the hilarious part is the fellow who played McKeith largely was a Broadway actor, and he became known for this part. So I found an obituary of him from almost, it was 15 plus years ago, and it was Scott Merrill, known for playing McKeith off Broadway. It's like, okay, but Ed Asner, Charlotte Ray, B. Arthur, Jerry Orbach, John Astin, and Jerry Stiller were all at various times in this production. You're thinking, these are all such terrific character actors. And John Astin and Jerry Stiller, B. Arthur Charles. I love all, I mean, these are like four or five of my favorite actors of that type and era were all in this production. Like, oh, that's fantastic. How delightful.
Your entire media life revolves around this musical.
Well, it's weird. Yeah. I didn't even know they were in that show. And it's more I find out. I'm like, oh yeah. Oh, so-and-so was, oh yeah. Well, it had prominent production. So a number of people, and it's got great roles and some great songs. So that helps attract that kind of actor, I think too.
Yeah, and I had no idea it ran for that long. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, even it's off-Broadway and in the 1950s, and it's a difficult, weird thing. And, you know, I mean, the houses were small, right? An off-Broadway house wasn't nearly as big, and it was cheaper to mount productions and blah, blah, blah. But still, to run for, like, you know, 2,700 performances is astonishing.
There's actually when I Googled this, it came up that the Boston Lyric Opera is putting it on next month.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I'm probably not going to be able to go see it because opera is expensive.
Rush tickets, student rush tickets, right?
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's interesting because it's actually, even though it is an opera, but it's kind of been co-opted by the general musical theater. It is often put on in this way, but this is an actual opera house that is putting it on.
That's interesting.
Yeah. There's not a lot of operas that you see like being revived on Broadway, you know?
Yeah, and it's not classical. I mean, they call it an opera, I think, because of the nature of it, right? Like, as opposed to the singing style. Like, I don't think this benefits from a musical comedy singing style. And then you've got the whole issue of how Kurt Vile thought about music. And there's all this, you know, the songs are all in attention. There's you know, the songs go ba 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 ba. They're like almost upbeat. There's fast tempo, you know, jazz rhythms, blues, and other kinds of modalities. And yet the songs are often singing about, we're killing people, everyone's dead, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, wow. But even the style is like, you're supposed to sing this. Like, this is the notes in the script, and you'll read Brecht talk about, well, I think Brecht less about the singing part, but it's you singing it against the beat. So you're not signed to sing this like da 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 da. You know, you're singing it ba 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 ba, you know, against it, so that you're challenging the music. And this is a little of the Steve Martin thing. You're not going with a conventional beat, bump, 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 and there's the punchline. It's you're making the audience have to work to stay along with you, but it's also a meaningful interpretation at the same time.
Forcing the audience to think.
Yeah, it's hard work.
How dare you?
Hard work.
We should talk about the music, which we haven't really talked about a lot yet until this just now. And the opening and closing of this show is the Ballad of Mac the Knife, which is like the translation / nickname for our not protagonist, but somewhat main character, McKeith. First of all, Mac the Knife, very interesting name. Mm-hmm. But also this ended up becoming the most popular song from the show, which is funny because it was added at the last minute because the actor really wanted a song.
I didn't know that until today. I had no idea. And I thought I knew something about this musical. I read criticism and other stuff. I never read that fact. And I'm so fascinated by it. It's a beautiful thing. It's a Maura Tate is a particular type of, the Maura Tate singer is like the, I forget what they call it, the ballad singer, but Maura Tate is more like a, it's like a, I don't know, it's a, there's a specific meaning of it that's more elegiac, I think, is it? It's not just like any ballad. It's like kind of a more of a, anyway, it's sort of a style. And the song, you know, is sort of a, here's what this guy is all about. And the translations are terrible. I mean, the song is really hard edge. And it's like, you know, one of the lines is in German, it's Und der Minderjährigen Witwe, deren Namen jeder weiß, wachtet auf und war geschändet. I can't remember the last line in German, but it translates as like the underage widow awoke and was ravished, was raped, and nobody knows who it was, but of course it's McKeith. And you're like, Jesus Christ almighty. And this is in the opening. This is like the next to last verse, you know, Shmuel Meyer's cash box gone missing. Nobody knows, but don't ask McKeith, you know? And so it's all these like death and rape and you're like, gee, you know, this is our introduction. And then it's like, hey, there's Mac. And he walks out. And the English translations, even the ones in the early versions that were staged, were a lot more toned down. You have to get to these later ones. Even the Raoul Julie one is a little bit harsher, but the Donmar Warehouse really digs in. But the commonly known versions of Mac the Knife are just so like he's like a hipster guy, has nothing to do, you know, even though it starts with, you know, see the shark, how red his teeth are as he slashes at his prey. I don't even know what the what the Pat Bennett lyrics are. I've forgotten them, but they're a lot more anodyne than that.
Yeah, this is the song has become like covered a lot by popular artists, which I assume was like this more toned down English version. I didn't realize how brutal it is. Whew. In the original.
I mean, the first verse is, I won't recite it in German because I don't remember it perfectly at the moment, but it's basically the shark has white teeth that he wears in his mouth. McHeath has a knife and he holds them in his, you know, white kid gloves, right? And so it's, that's a pretty translation, right? It's the literal one, but it's, that's what you're getting across is like, he's holding a knife in his white gloves in the same way a shark holds his teeth in his mouth. And you're like, that's the first verse. And the pop versions don't really convey that, you know, edge and violence that we're starting out the show with. But it's again, I think it's very Brechtian. I think it's great that it's in there. I'm still, I mean, if they didn't do that, the play would have started with, the opera would have started with Mr. Peachum, who is the king of the beggars, or the, who runs that area of town, right? He's collects money from all the beggars with his wake up, you sinners thing, you know, wach auf, du verrottende Christ, you know, wake up, you rotten Christians, and it would just go from there, and it would have been a very different thing. It would have the overture and then into that, but instead we get this stage setting that is, it is, you know, it's a showstopper. It's the orchestra plays, and a Moritate singer comes out and just sings with the, I think playing a accordion or something, like some kind of squeeze box, before we even start the musical. It's a very great framing and breaking device. Sorry, I didn't mean to sing so loudly. It just came back.
Well, I'll tell you right now, I don't think Michael Bublé was singing the original version of this song when he covered it. Just, like, in context, the fact that Michael Bublé sang Mac the Knife is very funny.
It's Mac the Knife.
Do you know, I just said Mike the Knife. Oh, well.
Mike the Knife. Mocky.
But it is like it's a good musical start to the show. And it's, I mean, I don't want to say fun because it's not fun, but like it has a lot of energy.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if you want to talk about, there's another famous song from it, although it's less known. This is how, you know, I think if you asked me that, I didn't answer your question, was how I came to this musical. Did you ask me that? And I walked right by the question.
Oh, I think we actually jumped right past that. But tell me that story. I want to know.
So I was dating somebody and she had a Kate Bush album who I'd never heard before. I must have been 17 or something, or 18. I never heard Kate Bush. And I was fascinated by Kate Bush's voice, as I still am. Not a huge fan, but I love her voice. And I mean, it's weird, you know, just, she's amazing. And she has a version of the Zeroiba Jenny, the Pirate Jenny song, and which is a very famous song from it. And I was blown away by this song. I just kept listening to it over and over. I'm like, oh my God, what is this song? Where does this come from? What a story it tells. Is this, you know, this, it's a story of like a washerwoman in a hotel and everyone treats her badly. And then this ship show up in the harbor with black sails and no one knows what they're about. And they start bombarding the town, and then they come into the town and start seizing people. And turns out she is the head of the pirates, and they bring everyone in the town to her, and she says, they say, should we take their head off? And she says, yes. And then the ship sail away with her on board, and that's her song. So songs from her first person. And you're like, oh my God, this is an amazing song. And then I'm listening to the radio, which we did in those days, as one did in those days. And I hear Nina Simone, who I did not know her music at all. And she has a wonderful Pirates
a scream song. In the night, and you wonder who could that have been.
Holy cow. And that made me fall in love with Nina Simone and listen to all Nina Simone. And that led me to the show. And then, so I'm studying German. I'd already studied German in high school a bit. I was more interested in the literature than the language, but I learned to speak it. I get to college and I start reading Threepenny Opera and just finding, you know, I never studied it in a class, I think, but we studied some Brecht in some classes. And I was always fascinated with the music and the nature of it, but that song at the center of it, I mean, much more than Mac the Knife, Zeroiba Jenny is the one that just, it's revolutionary, I think. Like, I can't think of any, I mean, when else does someone get up and sing a song about being a bloodthirsty pirate who in revenge for her treatment has killed everyone in a town? I mean, that's, that's subversive and wonderful. And I'm trying to think of the next song in musical theater history that would be like that until maybe Sweeney Todd. I don't know. There's probably something between that and Sweeney Todd, but it's the first one that comes to mind is like Mrs. Lovett's song.
Yeah.
They all deserve to die, even you, Mrs. Lovett, even I. I mean, that, you know, that's that.
Which is such a good song.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I experienced Sweeney Todd for the first time very recently, and it was an adventure.
I saw it in college. I'd seen a production on television with I'm blanking on his name. He's a wonderful actor, and I actually saw him live in a production at Yale, at the Yale Drama School. His name will come back to me. Wonderful performer in the lead, and he was in a production of O'Neill that I saw, and so I got to see him live. And at one point, stand a few feet away from him afterwards. It was very exciting. But he, they staged at Yale, the Undergraduate College Dramatic Association, the DRAT, which often staged good productions. It was people who were theater majors, you know the type, right? Theater majors, and often excellent productions, and. It was just fantastic, Mrs. Lovett. Like, it was so good. I went to see it a second time, which for an undergraduate production. I mean, I was undergrad, but I was kind of a theater snob. And I was like, wow. She went on to be, Melissa Errico. Is that the name, right? It's Melissa Errico. Isn't she the performer who's done so well since? She wound up becoming an Eliza. Yeah, Melissa Errico. Took over the role of Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady, like, I think right out of college or something, something wacky. And so I saw her, this is hilarious. I just finding her bio. I'm sorry. I don't mean to look it up, but during her freshman year, she auditioned for the role of Cosette and toured in a production in Les Miserables and then came back. And so she was at Yale at different times, but also performing professionally as well, which is amazing. And so I got to see her, and it was just another student. I didn't know about the Cosette and the touring, and she was phenomenal. I'm like, so the production of Sweeney Todd, so I was with this actress just before she went on Broadway as Eliza Doolittle in a great story. That's a great story too. Anyway, so I'm getting as far afield, but
this amazing. Podcast is about Sweeney Todd now.
That's all right. I talked about Sweeney Todd another time. It's great. Love that show.
Back to Three Penny Opera, though.
Three Penny Opera.
Which was the thing we were talking about. But now I've forgotten completely what we were talking about.
Well, I was telling you about, so I got sucked into it through that song, but it led me into this, I would say, lifelong thing. And what's funny is my wife did not study German. She studied French and Spanish. I studied German and Italian. And I somehow infected her with my love of this show. So she's a big musical. I did a lot of musical theater in high school. I was Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady, and she did, we were both in different productions across the country of The Man Who Stayed to Dinner. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? And what's the – I'm saying it wrong. The Kaufman play.
The Kaufman play?
The Kaufman play. George's Kaufman. It's the oh, my God. You can't take it with you. I'm sorry. They can't take it with you. I'm terrible. Anyway,
Who's Coming to Dinner is a different thing.
That's the whole thing. So I managed to infect her with my love of Three Penny Opera. So not only would she listen to the Raoul Julia version, but when I got the Donmar Warehouse one, she was into that as well. And she doesn't usually like such hard edge stuff. She has different tastes than I do. And in fact, we flew before we had children. We heard Bebe Neuwirth, as I mentioned earlier, was going to be performing at San Francisco, I think it's ACT, Actors Theater, something like that. And we heard she was going to be performing, and we immediately bought tickets, and we flew from Seattle to San Francisco and stayed with friends so we could see the show a few months after that. And my wife is deaf in one ear, and so we contacted the theater and said, is there accommodation for? They're like, oh, yes, whatever you like. Like, we can get you seats that are perfect. They're close to the students. This worked, whatever. We wound up in a first row directly in front of where Bebe Neuwirth sang all her songs. The staging of the show was not very good. So Bebe Neuwirth would come forward to this point, stage right. We are sitting stage left. She is 4 or 5 feet away from us, I think, singing all her songs. It was astonishing. And they gave her all the songs. They gave her a bunch of songs that Jenny doesn't sing in Three Penny Opera. So anyway, that is the extent of my commitment to this play.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not like following Tommy Tune from town to town. I'm not one of those people. But if there is, I know, any production of Three Penny Opera, I have to think about whether I can go see it. I have not seen another one since then. It was many years ago because it's not staged that often, as you know. But
yeah. Well, come to Boston. Apparently they're staging it here.
Oh, my God. I got to figure that out.
Well, you've got about 6 weeks.
Oh, my God. Probably won't happen. But
yeah. But it's wonderful to hear about, like, your to have such a long history of loving a show and being able to experience that show in so many different ways.
Ooh. Yeah, it's you settle into it and it becomes kind of background. I mean, that's why I feel like, I mean, and I'm lucky in that I studied in German and English, and I read criticism in German as well. So I can, what's fun, and having listened to so many recordings, seen three movie productions of it. No, two movie productions. There's the original, three, because there's an early one in English, early one in German by Pabst. There's the terrible production, unfortunately, with Raoul Julia, which is beautifully recorded, but the movie version, Roger Daltrey is the Mortate, the ballad singer, and he's wonderful, but he's not staged well. So with all of that in my head, and then the Donmar Warehouse, different translations, and the German, when I hear it, it's almost like I've got, you know, it's not like a Sherlock Holmes thing with overlays floating in text around me, but it's like there's a resonance across both the language and the different interpretations of it that comes to it, sometimes distracting because I hear something, oh, that's not quite right to me. So I try to drop in and listen to what's being said, you know, listen to the performance. But it's interesting always to hear the choices that are made, even sometimes small changes to words that deepen the meaning of it, that are closer to the original intent.
Wow, that's really cool. I wish I had that kind of linguistic familiarity with any other language so that could experience shows in different ways. That could be an interesting goal. Like, find a show that's originally in a different language and learn that language and then experience it in multiple ways.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, if you were to go in a direction where you wanted to be doing a lot of work in translation, it might be very useful at least to get some. I mean, you want to get grounding, I would think. But also, I mean, if you wind up doing a lot of that, but also if there's one particular culture of theater or language, it's like that might be a good reason to gradually learn the language, is because you'd be directing in it and have a better sense. I mean, this is like being a biblical scholar or a classical scholar. It's like, how much Greek and Latin do you need to know, and Aramaic and so forth, to understand? Because when you're in translation, you're, you know, looking through someone else's lens, and sometimes you're stuck too, because the translation is authorized by an estate or a playwright and you can't make alterations to it. And clearly Brecht's estate is pretty flexible. I mean, they defend the copyright pretty strongly, but they've allowed many translations, and it is, you know, it is still under copyright. So there's no question that this is being approved by parties who have licensing control. But there are many, many, many translations in many languages. And I think that's wonderful because it keeps the play alive and refreshed in over time, especially, I think, in the English versions that have come out.
Yeah, it's so easy in theater to just stick to English because so much theater has been produced in the United States, in England, especially in like popular theater, like American theater, kind of the American theater style kind of got exported across the entire world. And like, it's like, oh, our shows get translated to other languages, but there's also this rich theater traditions from other countries. And even like talking about like these shows that have been translated to English, but if you can understand the original language, then you can get more depth and understand what is going on behind these translations.
Wonderful.
I'm not exactly going to do that because, again, I only speak English, but
for now.
But yes, but it is important to remember that like there is a whole wide world out there, even if it's easy to get caught purely in English theater. Oh, and I do want to take a minute to talk about this movie, though. So I clicked on the Wikipedia page because it said like, if you go to the Wikipedia page for the Three Penny Opera, there's one of those like, oh, are you thinking of this? There's for the 1931 film, see the Three Penny Opera, 1931 film. For the 1990 film, see Mac the Knife. And I was like, this is going to be good. And so you click on it and I'm just like, oh no. It's from 1989. And there's a very dramatic movie poster with the tagline, scoundrel, liar, thief.
Oh my God.
They all loved him.
Oh my God, I don't know about that. That's hilarious.
Oh boy. And it's,
oh my goodness.
There's a bit where it says, this has never been released on DVD. There are no plans for a DVD release.
Oh, that's great. It is a tricky thing. The G.W. Pabst movie that's in, it was shot in German, but I think I may have seen it with English subtitles. I know it's from 1931, so it was made not long after the original production. Oh, by the way, I realized I said that, The Seven Deadly Sins precedes this. It's actually after Three Penny Opera. So just to make sure that's factually accurate. But the Pabst film, he was a very well-known filmmaker. And and you know, German cinema. And it's not wonderful. It's kind of slow and funky. I mean, it's 1931. Sound movies are pretty new then. But then there's the, and again, the Julia, Raul Julia film is kind of, it's not wonderful. It's and it's got great people. It's got Roger Daltrey, Julie Waters, Bill Nye, Richard Harris. I mean, this is not a bad cast, and it just felt like it was being kind of like sleepwalked through, and had none of the energy of the cast recording that was from it's from years before, right? Because it was a 76, 77 production that Julia was in. This is 10 plus years later. But it just didn't have the crispness. And it's just, Mack Heath has to be bloodthirsty. You have to believe there's a barely restrained, not evil, he's amoral. And he just has, he's a creature of desire. He knows how to get it. And he's smooth and suave, but he's a killer. And if less there's that menace, it doesn't work. And so there are Mack Heaths that just kind of seem like they're, you know, ho, 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 I'm a criminal, boo, boo, boo. And it's like, that's not it. No, you have to be willing to just stab somebody for whatever reason benefits you without any compunction whatsoever. That's the heart of that part.
Yeah, the adaptation doesn't really work into edgy. Like, he's not an edgy criminal. He's a bad dude.
Yeah, he's, but he's restrained. I mean, he's suave. He's sophisticated. He kind of makes his way through society at a certain level.
I also want to talk about one of the important mechanisms of the plot of this, which is this sort of beggar army that is concocted by Peachum, the father of the woman that McKeith marries. And so the plot of the show goes that, like, Peachum kind of runs the beggars in this city to the point where, like, it's a very much a mob thing. Like, anyone who begs in his territory when they're not permitted to gets beat up, and then they have to pay fees, and, like, he gets a percentage of all that they make. And it's really twisted. I mean, like, that's kind of the point. Like, this is supposed to be a significant criticism of capitalism. And then they're kind of utilized almost as an army as the plot progresses. And Peachum is fighting against McKeith and is threatening the city with, like, unleashing the beggars upon the town. And it gets very intense.
Yeah, I mean, the plot of the thing is very simple, is that... that's right. The overall plot is McKeith is going along his life, but once he marries Jenny, Mr. Peachum is aggravated and basically wants to get him caught and killed. But McKeith, I'm sorry, this is the spoiler part, right? I'm going to actually tell you the plot, fire off the spoiler horn. And so he consults the chief of police, but the chief of police is an old army buddy of, which is, you know, big deal, of Tiger Brown. It's very easy to translate Tiger Brown to Tiger Brown. This old police army buddy of McKeith's, and always protects him because they were in a lot of wars and whatever. And but eventually Mr. Peachum seems to convince Brown to do it, but McKeith is going to leave town and go off somewhere else and leave Polly in charge. But he goes to see Spelunker Jenny, who works in a brothel. And is the first woman he pimped out years before, and they sing a song about that. And Jenny betrays him and turns him into Brown. Brown arrests him, and he's, you know, going to hang. And then there's Brown's daughter Lucy's also involved with McKeith, of course. And there's this whole thing. What is it, Jenny? Jenny wants her money to betray McKeith. Mrs. Peachum is supposed to pay her. Then she reveals that McKeith is at Suki Tawdry because he's escaped. And Brown then finally grabs him. The beggars are in position to disrupt the queen's coronation. I missed that part. No, when he's at Jenny's, he escapes. It's later. He's at Suki Tawdry, another girlfriend or whatever. And Brown arrests him. He's scheduled to be executed. He sings songs in jail. He's trying to get a bribe to get out. His gang, and no one can raise enough money for it. He sings these questions, and then all of a sudden there's a happy ending, and it's and because of her coronation, the queen demands that Captain McKeith be released forthwith and raised to the nobility and given a pension of £10,000.
McGee set at liberty forthwith.
And it's this whole ridiculous, completely absurd happy ending that's just slapped on the end as kind of this, you know, ridiculous thing. And then the last part, which is great, is you know, he sings the song Reprieve It. He said, I knew it was coming. It's that when you're at your greatest need is when hope is coming. And then Peachum, because we're breaking the wall, says, and remain all standing where you're standing and hear the hymn of the poorest of the poor, whose most arduous life you've heard portrayed here today. For in fact, the poor come to very wicked ends. The savior on horseback is infrequent in practice. And you're like, so he's just like undermining the super happy ending by saying, yeah, yeah, happy endings don't really happen. We showed you one, but really the poor are usually undertrodden. But who is trotting them underfoot? He is. He's running a protection racket and teaching people to steal. And that's kind of the whole play. I mean, it's a kind of a thin plot at some level. It's really, we got to arrest McKeith, get him in jail because he married my daughter. And how do we do that?
Yeah, Brecht is not really this isn't even a Brecht, though. This is because the plot is very similar to the original Beggar's Opera.
Yeah, it's like little sort of tweaks and structure to make it more, you know, I mean, it's his thing. He's kind of, but it's a very good thing. He's hanging his ideas on top of this structure people know, because the Beggar's Opera had been performed, obviously, a number of times. It had its own music. And my recollection reading today is that only one of the songs, one of the melodies from the original Beggar's Opera was used. Weill composed mostly original music, but, you know, the songs are partly adapted from the original play. There's four Zedvion poems turned into songs. It's, you know, it's a pastiche, but it's got his message running through it.
And he's not interested in having this message be subtle. Like, that's completely not in his style, or anything that he wants. Like, he wants this to be front and center.
Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things, too, is that in different productions, as I said, like Jenny is kind of a subsidiary role, is not in the play much in productions in the way it's usually staged. But when you have Lota Lenya or Bibi Neuwirth playing Jenny, you give them more songs. And so in different productions, Jenny, it's funny. So Pirate Jenny is not sung by Spelunker Jenny. Pirate Jenny is sung by Polly while she's waiting for MacHeath to show up. And he shows up. He's like, that's not really an appropriate song for you to be singing. You won't be doing any more of that after we're married. You know, and all his criminal buddies have populated this house that I think they've taken over with stuff he's stolen in order to stage the wedding in the first place. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, so the Jenny role winds up, I think Bibi Neuwirth was given, I don't remember how many, maybe four or five extra songs in the production I saw. It was some of them were equity actors. Some were students. It was a student, ACT, I think it was a student, or it was a college, performing arts college. But they had Bibi, so they gave her more to sing.
Are you ready for the lightning round?
Okay.
All right. Favorite song?
I have two for different reasons. So I'm going to cheat. So the canon song is, this, I was just reading, the canon song comes early in the show. It's like the fourth song. And it's when it looks like MacHeath's about to be arrested by the chief of police, Tiger Brown. It turns out they're buddies. And they sing this song. And it is an amazing song. And apparently, this I just read today, I didn't know this, during the first performance in Germany, the audience watched stonily and did not react at all. Everyone's like, scheisse, what's going to happen here? And then the song comes on and everyone flips out. And from that moment on, it was clear it was going to be a success. But it's like, the troops live under. It's just this incredible, you know, again, this kind of peppy thing about the brutality of war and the state system that chews people up. So I love that song for that reason. But the one that I keep coming back to is What Keeps Mankind Alive, which people probably know best, if you don't know the musical, from Tom Waits' rendition, which is incredible, right? But there's this line, and I keep coming back to this. It's like, you know, what keeps mankind alive? The fact that billions are daily tortured, stifled, punished, silenced, and oppressed. Mankind can keep alive thanks to its brilliance. And keeping its mind can keep alive thanks to his brilliance of keeping its humanity repressed. And you're like, what are we living through right now? But those lines, holy cow. So that's a great, that song just will chew you up, and listen to Tom Waits' version of it. Fantastic.
Amazing choices. What's your favorite line from the musical?
Well, this is another one I quote all the time. This is from, it's a second finale, I think is what it's called. You gentlemen who think you have a mission to save us from the seven deadly sins should first sort out
the basic food position. Then start your preaching. That's where it begins. You lot who preach restraint and watch your waist as well should learn for once the way the world is run. However much you twist, whatever lies you tell, food is the first thing. Morals follow on.
And then this is the line. So first be sure that those who now are starving get proper helpings when we all start carving. And I come back to that line. So first be sure that those who now are starving get proper helpings when we all start carving. And it is very true to the German. And it is very hard to hear because, again, what are we living through? What is the state of mankind? That is it.
Oh, no, I'm going to be thinking about that one.
Sorry. You need an antidote. You need to watch something, a light and fluffy musical that can replace these briefly.
Your favorite character?
Low Dive Jenny.
Excellent.
As I said, the only seemingly sympathetic, partially sympathetic character in the show, maybe, but she has good songs, too.
Yes, she does. And if you could play a character in the show, who would you want to play?
Oddly, not McKeith. I don't think I have the edge for McKeith, but Mr. Peachum, I feel I could play, and he has terrific songs, and a lot of them. He sings a lot. I think maybe even more than McKeith. Well, no, McKeith has some solo numbers, but so Mr. Peachum would be the role. It's perfect for me at my age now, too.
I would see you as Mr. Peachum.
Thank you.
Who would you?
The Ed Asner part, apparently.
Oh, there you go. Who would you recommend go see this show?
I think anybody with a political bent would love it. I think there's a little bit, people who, you know, there's like a historical aspect and there's the musical counterpoint. I don't know if the music is considered that sophisticated by musicians or not. I think it's really an interesting slice of time and Vile employs a lot of styles, but I think if you want to see something that is, challenging and didactic, but actually makes you leave the theater with all the songs in your head, this is the show. And it teaches you things. I think it's actually a tool to understand the world a little better, too, even if it's through Brecht's eyes.
And finally, if you could combine this with another musical, which one would you choose?
Oh, gosh. I was thinking about this. I was trying to think of anything. I mean, like I say, Cabaret is a little like it. I think there's aspects. Sweeney Todd owes something to it. I think there's Sondheim. But I don't know that I could think of another thing that would mesh with it. What I'd really love to see is I'd like to see like a one-man show of Tom Waits doing the whole thing, maybe with a couple other performers for help. But that would be incredible. But there are some things. I think Canada had a production that was like a bunch of Brecht and Vile songs years ago, and it was like all these famous musicians singing them, like, you know, Fiona Apple and I forget who else, and it's amazing. And so there are some incredible albums full of people singing Brecht and Vile songs, but I can't think of another musical that you could make have sense with this and get something out of it.
Well, I appreciate your thoughts and analysis on it anyway.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end. Thank you so much for being on this episode.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to talk about this and such a pleasure to know that you're excited about learning about this new show and this new director, writer, everything. So that's exceptionally fun for me.
Absolutely. And I hope that people listening are either very excited that someone talked about it or excited to check it out now. So thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find us online at theincomparable.com/COTS or follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. Don't forget to check out theincomparable.com/members if you're interested in supporting this show or any other of your favorite Incomparable shows. If you would like to, you could also review us in iTunes or recommend us in Overcast. Until next time. Honestly, everyone in this musical is too dangerous for me to make a cute reference out of.